I need voices, yes? Okay. So I wanted to share with you some of the partners that we had in this project. And this is not all of them, but these are some that had significant roles. And you'll see the diversity of players involved. And I'll share with you a little bit about who they are and how they participated. In Boston, we worked with the Boston Indicators Project. And the Boston Indicators Project is an effort of the Boston Foundation. So it's an operating foundation, so they actually run programs out of the foundation. It was a partnership of about a dozen other organizations in Boston, and they were some of the early players in the project. This was one of the places where they had an endless vetting process. For better or for worse, they had an endless vetting process. It was all about community participation and being able to validate the ideas and what have you. And at the time, we didn't have all of the premises that I've shared with you formulated. So we didn't have to offer them what I've shared with you, but there was a very heavy vetting process in this. The Great Valley Center I mentioned before, it is a nonprofit organization whose charge it is to improve quality of life in the Great Valley. So it's not an art-specific entity, it is more general. And they had a really interesting process in that they did a lot of forecasting. So they did a lot of population visioning. So they would, you know, they had these workshops that were about the Great Valley 2050. And what the population would look like and what the implications were for different sectors. And there was an effort to integrate arts and culture in that. But the biggest pop for me was that they were able to influence some of the transportation policy. The Chicago MCIC, I mentioned before, and the other partner we had in Chicago was the Field Museum. And specifically, there was an anthropologist in the Field Museum, Alika Wally, who's a wonderful colleague. We hooked Alika up with MCIC because they didn't work together before. And Alika, through her work as an anthropologist, helped the quantitative researchers at MCIC figure out how to aggregate the data about amateur arts practice. So that was a really nice collaboration between an anthropologist and other kinds of statisticians to arrive at the data that I shared with you, the story I shared with you. Unfortunately, MCIC is now out of business. So all of the work that I was so hopeful about hopefully will take life somewhere else, but it's no longer in business. At the Great Valley Center, it still continues. The person who was the champion of this has moved on to a university. So I share this with you so that you understand the transient and you would hope that you build something with an institution and that it's there forever. But the reality is that often it's not, and sometimes things are instituted and there's traction, but sometimes there isn't. So I'm sharing a mixed story with you. Let's see, in Denver, the Piton Foundation was an early collaborator, and it too is an operating foundation like the Boston Foundation, and they have an indicators initiative that is in partnership with all of these organizations around the Denver area. And they use our national data. I don't think they've done a lot in terms of developing local data, but they do use the national data. In Long Beach, the partner was the Arts Council for Long Beach. Long Beach, is anyone familiar with Long Beach at all? It is a super interesting city, maritime tradition just south of Los Angeles, very diverse, has a lot of character, a lot of craft. There's a lot of ethnic-specific creative expression and art, lots of festivals. The Arts Council is one of the weakest in the country, well, at least in the state. At the time, it wasn't officially part of the city. It was a nonprofit with a dotted line relationship to the city, so it could be ignored fairly easily. Since then, they've reorganized, and now it's part of the Economic Development Department, I think, for the city. So it's had a lot of reshaping and transition. It was interesting because the original director that we started working with was very enthusiastic about this, and she was really eager to work with other divisions in the city, even though they weren't officially part of the city. And it was very hard for her to get their attention or to garner resources from them, in part because of how they were situated. She then retired, and there were lots of transitions in leadership. So whatever headway was made with her in some ways was lost because of the change in leadership over time. This is over the course of about 3 or 4 years. The Los Angeles County Music Center and the LA County Arts Commission, Laura Zucker at the LA County Arts Commission makes things happen, and she is still there. So she is still happily plodding along, trying to integrate arts and culture into anything that she can, and she's very persuasive. So that is a happy story. One of the things that we were able to do through the LA County Arts Commission was that, following the lead of Seattle, as I mentioned to you, is Seattle King County Public Health. In Los Angeles, we were able to integrate arts and culture questions into the LA County Public Health Survey. So now there is an instrument that happens. It's a survey that happens every year, and they ask questions about cultural participation as part of what they're doing for health. And the Music Center, they've been experimenting. The Music Center is one of these cultural temples in big cities. It is one of the things that allows LA to claim some status as a world-class city, because it has these big presenting institutions that, and they do good work as presenters. They've been called on the carpet a lot for not being accessible to the majority of the population because it's very expensive. There's a woman who was very visionary there, who was she was a program vice president, and she started this program called the Active Arts Program. And what she did was transform the campus of the Music Center into something that is accessible for everyone. So they had this series of events that was about active arts engagement. And it was an invitation to all Angelenos who had an interest in whatever the topic was at the time. So, for example, they would have Get Your Chops Back nights, and it was for anyone who had ever been in band and loved it. And they had, like, flute night, and everybody would come out with their flutes, and they would play on the campus of the Music Center. And, you know, these are beautiful buildings that had been understood as kind of off limits. So here you have all these amateurs playing the flutes on the grounds of the Music Center. The other thing, they had drum night, and everybody came out with drums. They would have dance parties where they wouldn't employ professional dancers. They would employ highly skilled amateur dancers to help or teach a dance, whatever it was, whether it was tango night or whatever, to whoever assembled, and they were dance parties at the Music Center. So it was this really important way of animating the space and helping the performing arts venue stay true to its venue, because it is a public venue. It's supported by the county. Help them stay true to their mission of civic engagement, which was part of why they were established. And they've been doing some experimenting with how do you capture participation for programs like this, which is kind of interesting. But just the notion of active arts engagement, I think, is really worth paying attention to, particularly in a venue like this. The other thing at the dance parties, you guys know what the electric slide is? No? Oh, it's going to fall flat. It's kind of like line dancing. You know what line dancing is? Okay. So electric slide is something everybody does at weddings to get everybody on the dance floor. You know, somebody plays this little silly song, the electric slide, and everybody gets out on the dance floor. And whether you can dance or not, it's a really easy line dance. All of the dances at the Music Center started with the electric slide. So whether you were going to do gamelan, whether you were going to do tango, whatever you were going to do was going to start with the electric slide just to get people moving. But it's a fantastic program, and it's online, too. You should check it out if you have a chance. Did I hit this by mistake? I must have. Let me go back. Okay. So anyway, but they've been partners in crime in trying to get, well, not partners in crime. They've been partners in trying to get other entities in LA County to pay attention to arts and culture as what they care about. So the United Way, are you familiar with the United Way at all? So in the U.S., it's a big NGO, it's a big nonprofit organization that is concerned with the well-being of families. And it's national, and there's local branches all over the country, and they usually have data systems to track certain things related to the status of families. So we had spoken with the guy from United Way Los Angeles to try to get him interested in integrating arts and culture into his measures of family well-being. And at first, he was very resistant because he thought arts and culture was elitist. And if you are concerned with low income and poor communities, why would you do something with arts and culture? So we had to, you know, get him to see the bigger picture. And he connected on the idea of theater and at-risk youth. So that was the hook. And then because he had kids who were teenagers and he understood the power of the programs that his kids were experiencing at the park that were about theater, he kind of became an advocate for it. So we thought, oh, okay, good. We have an in with the United Way. They'll integrate arts and culture into their measurement systems about families. And that's another thing, another good example that we could, you know, because at the national level, we wanted to hold up examples of where this was happening. He left the United Way and went to another organization. So hopefully he took that bit of information with him and will do good things with it somewhere else. But as of now, the United Way still does not have arts and culture measures. In Oakland, the Urban Strategies Council, they have a data system. They use the national measures, which is, you know, that's a victory too, but they haven't taken the step to include local measures. And the Urban Strategies Council is a nonprofit arts organization that is concerned with low-income communities. So they're concerned with neighborhood revitalization and all of the things that come with that. Metropolitan Philadelphia Indicators Project, that is very similar to the Metropolitan Chicago Information Center. MPIP is still functioning and strong, and they have both local and national arts and culture indicators in their system, and have worked with us for years. The Social Impact of the Arts Project is something, if you're not familiar with it, you should check it out. They're based at University of Pennsylvania, and they do a lot of work on social impact of the arts. So they're developing theories and proving them with quantitative data in terms of not economic impacts, but other kinds of social impacts. And they do most of their work in Philadelphia. In Pittsburgh, again, it was another indicator initiative that was a nonprofit. Same thing with Providence Plan. It was kind of a quasi-governmental planning agency. So when I say quasi-governmental, it had 501c3 status, which is nonprofit status in the U.S., but it also had official charges from government. So they sort of had a dotted line relationship to the city. The Federal Reserve Bank is a big national system that has to do with regulating monetary transactions around the country in some cities, and they have branches, local branches. This one was St. Louis. In some cities, they also dabble in community development. So in St. Louis, we were partnering with them. San Luis Obispo is a community foundation Santa Monica already talked with you about, and the partner there was also the Environmental Program Division. Seattle, King County, I shared with you. And in Washington, D.C., we were partners with D.C. Neighborhood, Neighborhood Info D.C., sorry, which was a community indicators initiative. They were never that proactive about integrating the data. They only used it if they were asked by somebody else. So they did not make a long-term commitment to integrate it. And the Smithsonian Folklife Center, which is the big national museum system, they have a folklife program, and they were helping us think through how would you capture amateur arts practice, how would you capture what people think of as folk arts, et cetera. So it was a really interesting mix of players that were involved in the project. At the beginning, we had these meetings, national meetings, we call them National Applied Learning Community Meetings, and they were comprised of people from these kinds of organizations, as well as artists, arts administrators, and data specialists. And people who were invited because they had an inclination and were interested in the topic. They met over the course of about 2 years. The first, I'd say, three meetings were horrible, absolutely horrible, because people were coming from different professional realities, even though they were all respectful and were aligned because they cared about the arts and thought it was important. The artists had a terrible time in listening to the statisticians. The statisticians didn't have patience with the artists. The arts administrators were kind of out of the loop when it came to the community development people. Over time, they found a way to talk with each other and actually figure out how they were going to work together. We had to develop a glossary to help people navigate the different terms, because there was terms that they were, you know, everybody had their terminology that they were committed to, and it was a new language that had to be created and bridged. But over time, it became a group that had a lot of respect for each other, and they began to see the value of possibly working together or at least informing each other's practices. But it was not an easy road. And now, at the national level, I mentioned this before, part of what the National Endowment for the Arts is doing, there's a revival of interest in comprehensive strategies, and there's an interest in integrating arts and culture into how we think about comprehensively addressing neighborhoods and cities. And they are having meetings similar to what we had with this Arts and Culture Indicators Project, where you have people from Housing and Urban Development, from the National Endowment for the Arts, from Department of Education, Department of Transportation, some artists thrown in as well, and they're having very similar meetings. We had the benefit of being funded by a foundation that had the tolerance for the kind of process that had to happen before these people could work together effectively. And it was also something that was not a very high profile thing. So this was kind of not an under the radar project, but it was something that we purposefully at that point wanted to keep fairly low profile. At the national level, in an election year, you can't do that. So you have the situation where you have the convergence of people who are inclined to do good and concerned with the arts and are trying to figure out how to work with it, but they don't have the luxury of time, and they don't have the luxury of being low profile either. So it is a political reality when you think about how much progress can you make. When you know that it's going to take maybe 3 or 4 months at least for this group to gel enough to come up with something productive, and it's not acceptable to say we met for 4 months and that was our work, when it was the work. So that is just a political reality. So any questions about this or something? Okay. You get it? Oh, good. Yeah. At the beginning, we had what we called lube money. So we had small resources. We didn't want the participation to be fueled only by the money. So it was enough to get their attention, but not enough that if they weren't already inclined, they would go for it. And that was a very strategic way that we decided to go. Once we had more to offer, people joined and signed up on their own terms. What we provided to them was whatever resources we had already developed. We could give them the data, we could give them access to other people that could help them or that were colleagues around the country. But at the beginning, we were providing money. Small. Say that again? Uh-huh. I was the project director, so I was a principal investigator on the project, and there were about three other staff members that were not quite full-time, maybe half-time each. Yeah. But the collective we, besides the staff people whose job it was, were many people from here. Yeah. And then the other thing we tried with some modest success was that we had the local apply, I'm sorry, the national applied learning communities, which I was describing, and we were trying to seed local applied learning communities where there would be a mirror process at the local level, and they would also assemble. And in some places, it worked better than in others. In other places, that just wasn't a viable way to go because there was nobody to staff the collective. Or, you know, there wasn't enough leadership to pull it together. In some places, it was viable. Other questions about this group or what I've talked about so far? Okay. So some necessary conditions for adoption and use of arts and culture indicators. There has to be a demand for the data. And this is, can be a kind of chicken or egg thing, because on one hand, you think, oh, there has to be demand, and then the data will follow. But in fact, sometimes if there isn't data, you can't stimulate demand, or people can't envision what it is. Does that make sense? But if there isn't demand, either way, it's tough. If nobody thinks it's important, if nobody thinks that it is critical, if no one relies on it to do their work, there's a question about relevance. And the data has to be relevant. So the data has to, and when I say that, meaning that it has to be as current as it can be. And the level of geography is no small thing. Being able to deliver data at the right geographic level is a really big challenge. Because a lot of times, you know, we were often very happy because we thought we had found a data source that could deliver, only to find out that you could only get the data at the metropolitan statistical area, and that was the smallest geography, which meant that people who were working at the city level could do very little with it. And even smaller, if you were working at the neighborhood level or community level, it was even less relevant. So the geography issue is an important one. Arts-related data must be able to interact with other types of data to arrive at impact. So here, there has to be a concerted effort to figure out how you can do analysis. If you're interested in making statements about impact or testing assumptions about impacts outside of intrinsic impacts, you really do need access to the data that can allow you to ask the questions. So for example, if there is in the case of Chicago, if there's high incidence of amateur arts participation, does it have an impact on public safety? You need public safety data and a certain kind of arts data to do the runs and do the analysis and figure out how to answer that question. Arts and culture data ambassadors are necessary, and by that, that's kind of the role that I played in the Santa Monica example, where there was somebody who had an interest in gathering the data but didn't quite know how to do it, and she needed help in reaching out to people who could be partners and colleagues in helping her with her process. So I happened to play that role for her there, but there are other ways of catalyzing those kinds of relationships and identifying those resources. This is a really important one. Standards or goals about arts amenities are necessary. So in the United States, I don't know what the deal is here, but with the exception of some edicts about arts education, where you have some states that say every school must have X number of arts hours of arts instruction or employ arts teachers or what have you, there is very little, if anything, that says something about what is acceptable, desirable, or unacceptable about arts amenities. So there is nothing that says there must be an art center in every neighborhood, or there must be X number of working artists per 1,000 population. So in housing, it's very clear, you know, what decent and affordable housing is supposed to look like and how much you're supposed to have. In the environment, there are clearly things that you shoot for or try to stay away from in terms of pollution and, you know, air quality or what have you. In the arts, there's really nothing. So absent any kind of edict that says it is unacceptable to not have X or you must have, why, it's very easy to dismiss. And this is where comparative data becomes interesting and important, because without those kinds of goals, standards, edicts, you rely on comparisons to try to establish some kind of aspiration. So cities are, there are in the states, there are always clusters of cities that are competitive with each other. If you have data about an arts characteristic in one place, and you rank people, and they see that they're under so-and-so, if Baltimore is under Cleveland, they're going to be real mad, and they're going to want to do something about it. So there, the comparative data becomes important. Or, for example, Austin, Texas, has a reputation for being a very vibrant music scene. So if you have data about the music scene in Austin, and there's another place that aspires to be like Boston, like Austin, or compete with it, then they're going to look to see how they fare in terms of that characteristic in comparison to whatever. So does that make sense, that by default, the comparison in some ways replaces what ideally would be some kind of official standard or some kind of official decree about what is desirable, acceptable, or unacceptable. And people, I feel strongly about that, but then I've heard people say, well, you can't say, if you do that, then you know people can say, well, there's too much art. You've met the minimum, so there's too much art. And I suppose that there's some danger to that, maybe, but I can't imagine that there isn't a way around it. And I think the lack of some kind of collective aspiration is more detrimental than the possibility that someone would say there's too much art. Participation of all is implicated. What I meant by that was that the arts agency isn't going to be able to do all of this alone. Partnerships are required, and you need to figure out what is the web or consortium of people that will propel you to achieve what you need to achieve in terms of indicators. There has to be leadership and vibrant leadership, I think, to pull this off. And patience and persistence is really important. And the Santa Monica piece was a testament to that. And I shared this with Kim earlier. When I started doing this work, I was in my 20s. And the very wise woman who funded this was at the Rockefeller Foundation. She was my program officer. And I didn't know what she was talking about at the time, but when I took this project on, she said, it's a good thing you're young. And now, 17 years later, I understand why she said that. But incidentally, I mean, she left the foundation. She's now the second in command at the National Endowment for the Arts. Guess who's implementing the recommendations from 10 years ago about the survey of public participation in the arts and how useless it was for indicators. So at some point, things come around. It's taken a while. It's taken a while, but with it's a cause that is not for the faint of heart. But if you seed things wisely, I think something will take root. But you have to be able to see it in lots of different places. That's been one of the lessons that I've learned with this work. And last, so these are some things that are, I think, that bode well. That isn't the slide. These are just some things for the arts field to consider. So it's not last. There's one more slide after this. If the arts field, at least from the U.S. experience, if it wants to be part of broader policy discussions, these are some things to consider. And there's a woman who I respect a great deal who is in New Orleans, Carol Beville. She's an arts administrator, and she said that 80% of her job sometimes was being at the table, because if you're not at the table, you might be on the menu. That's what she said. So she's very quotable. The other thing that she said in relation to arts and culture, because people sometimes grapple with what's the difference between arts and what's, you know, what's arts and what's culture. And her thing was, she said, culture, she said, arts is the favorite daughter, but culture is the big mama. Meaning that if you didn't feed culture, you wouldn't have art, which gets to the, I think, is analogous to some of the things that I've been saying in terms of broad interpretations and appreciation for non-professional practice as well. So anyway, broader interpretation of arts and culture and the related impacts, I think, is really important if there is an effort to connect to other policy areas. More nuanced understanding and language about arts participation, even though we've made some strides, I think, in this work in trying to unpack the notion of participation, there is still largely a default to audience when people think about arts engagement. There is an automatic default to this idea of bums or butts in seats, and that overrides other kinds of engagement, even though we know that people are engaging in very different ways and in active ways. There is better collection of arts and culture data now, but there's more work to be done on that. There needs to be better understanding of relevant data outside of the arts field. So getting back to that Santa Monica example, the data that you need may be some other place. It is probably not in the Cultural Affairs Department for many of the things that you are concerned with. Partnerships with entities having data and research capacity is really important. In most cases, in my experience, the Cultural Affairs Department does not have the research or technical capacity to either do the analysis or clean the data and make it available for use. And they rely, the best ones rely on partnerships, either with universities or other organizations like some of the ones that I've mentioned earlier parts of this discussion. The emphasis on economic impacts and the defensive posture of the arts and cultural field, I think, diminishes opportunities to explore other connections, contributions, and impacts. And that's something that I see a little bit of progress on in the U.S. context, but the economic development argument, the economic impact argument, still dominates in ways that diminish other kinds of contributions that are also really important. And I don't say that the economic impact argument is something that should be abandoned or ignored, because that would be stupid. I think that it's really important to pursue that and to do that well. In addition to that, though, I think we should pay a lot of attention to the other kinds of impacts that are also important. And I said this before, but lack of standards and goals in the field diminishes the political position, and the creation and assertion of standards and goals, I think, is an important thing. And these are some contextual things that I think are favorable right now. There's better data, at least in the U.S., than there was 15 years ago. There's better and more data. There are emerging and more nuanced research on arts impacts. So people are thinking about contributions to health, contributions to civic engagement, and there's actually research and data about it. There's interest in creativity as a global economic engine, and that's greater than it's ever been. So people really are concerned with having creative citizenry if they're going to be globally competitive. There's interest in social capital, collective efficacy, and civic engagement. Again, things that people associate with arts participation. This idea of new urbanism, so people are interested in being back in the center of cities again, and as a reaction to the homogenization of suburban places, there's an interest in craft, the slow food movement, things that are locally made. All of that ties into the idea of new urbanism, and I think that also provides some fuel for thinking about arts and culture as something that people want to measure in their communities. And in the U.S. context, again, there's a revival of interest in comprehensive approaches to cities. And this revival, I say revival because it happens about every 25 years. Something kicks off, and all of a sudden there's recognition that the problems of the city are multiple and interrelated, and that responses to the city have to be multiple and interrelated. And we are at that moment in the U.S. now, where out of the national administration, there are all of these programs that are about place-based comprehensive strategies, and hence the National Endowment for the Arts trying to integrate arts and culture into those, and there being some receptivity to it. So there is a moment now, I think, where, especially if there's another Obama administration, there will be some room for traction in that. If there isn't, I don't know. But there is this moment where there can be traction. And what I've seen in these cycles is that you use typically, you know, 3-4 steps forward, 2 steps back. So maybe this time, if it's another cycle, the 2 steps forward that don't go back will include consideration of the arts and comprehensive strategies. That's my hope. But we need time so people can have those meetings and develop the glossaries and do the things they need to do to be able to work effectively. So I'm going to stop there. And we have a group exercise that Marnie is going to tell you about. But are, were there any questions or comments before we do that? Because I don't want to cut off discussion. If it depends on if you're talking about the national level, it's really is predicated by presidential administrations. So they're increments of 4 years. If you're talking about the local level, there's more flexibility usually. Yeah. In arts education, yes. In terms of other aspects of cultural vitality, I see very little evidence of that. I suppose the other thing that might count is that many cities have a percent for art program. Are you guys familiar with that here? So that's a requirement, you know, which in some ways is an edict. It's a standard. It's something that to pay attention to. But other than that, I don't see a whole lot. You raise a good point, and I think for some it's ideological, and for others it's real. Yeah. In some instances it's real. So, for example, when you look at crime data, you could make some really bad decisions if you don't look at localized crime data. If you assume that the crime patterns are the same for a large geography that encompasses many different kinds of neighborhoods, and you assume that the pattern of behavior is going to be the same, that's bad. For other kinds of dynamics, it may not be the same. So I think it depends on what question you want to answer, whether or not locality is really as important as one might think. But for some, it's just ideological. It's just, you know, if it's not about this, I can't look at it, which isn't always the smartest thing to do. Keep fighting this. Well, one thing, when even quote-unquote anecdotal stuff, if it's done rigorously, it's qualitative data. So I've often counseled a lot of arts administrators to think about the natural ways in which they know what they know. And a lot of times that comes up as quote-unquote anecdote. But if you put just a little more structure to it and rigor to it, that can actually become very formalized data that can either stay qualitative or eventually become quantitative. So I always am a little cautious when someone, and I'm not saying you said this, but I'm always cautious when someone tells me, oh, all I have is anecdotal data and I can't do any more than that. Because it doesn't, often it doesn't take that much to kick it up to the next level. Anything? But we're about to go ahead. Let me just say this, though, because the one thing, as I've been observing what's happening at the National Endowment for the Arts in this presidential administration, they're not really relying on data. Shared this with you. There's a moment now where at the federal level there is an openness to the value of arts and culture. And I think that the advocates in the U.S. that have been advocates of the arts for so long are so used to trying to make the case that they're missing the opportunity to actually seize some ground where there's an opening. Does that make sense? So what I'm seeing with, for example, the chairman of the endowment is that he's forged these partnerships with the agency heads of other agency heads. So Department of Transportation, Department of Health, Department of Education, Department of Transportation. And recently, when there was a proposal for a cut at the federal level, it was those other agency heads that went to bat with him, not so much because they had data, but because they had these relationships and they had these projects on the ground that they all believed in. So I think the data is important and it's valuable, but that in and of itself is not going to be the panacea. I think it is figuring out how to cast the arts as inextricably bound from the well-being of the people that these folks are accountable to. I think you're right. And recently, at the local level in lots of places, during the U.S. recession, and we're moving out of it, but at its worst, you had the arts, in my opinion, you had the arts community in many places coming in a very protectionist mode that was, you know, don't cut me. It was about don't cut me. And the posture really, it didn't work. You know, everybody was getting cut. Now, it's true, the arts were probably going to get cut first, but everybody was going to get cut. And to come in with "don't cut me," it's not going to work. I mean, it was an all hands on deck moment in terms of the economic reality in many places. And I think that the arts field would have come in a lot stronger if it came in as part of the solution. If instead of saying "don't cut me," it was more about here's why this is important at this moment. But if you're used to making a different argument, it's hard to go to that. And that's one of the things that I see with arts advocates in the States again right now, is that there is this opening to gain some ground, but they're busy singing the old song. And they don't know how to engage the folks that might help them gain some ground, a different kind of ground. Not the kind that is about lobbying for direct money to the arts, but the kind that is about sharing a pot, a different pot. Yeah. So we have a little bit of time. There's a group exercise which, if anything, it'll just get you thinking. If you haven't thought about these questions, or if you have thought about them, it's an opportunity to share with your other group members what you think. So, Marnie, you want to explain? So, it's about 3:50 now. So, just quickly, take a look at the questions and let me know if anything isn't clear or if we need to talk about... The first question, Kim, can you give me a copy of the questions? So the first question is asking you to, in your group, create a value statement about the arts for your community. And just to remind you, in the discussion, We didn't find anything that was clearly articulated at the beginning, but de facto, the way in which people were collecting data said we care about audience participation, financial well-being of nonprofit arts organizations, and the well-being of the sector. That's what it was de facto, even from the actions. But I'm asking you to consider what would be the value statement that you would want to put forward. Once you've done that, take that into consideration and identify up to 5 indicators that you would want to track over time. And think about why you picked it and how it connects to the value statement. Next, for each of the indicators, think about, does the data already exist? And you may not know the answer to that, but you then think about, where might it exist? Who might I turn to for this kind of information if you don't already know? And does it require new data collection? Consider that as well. The fourth question is, what entity is most appropriate to house and make the indicators available? Is it you? Is it somebody else? Is it a partnership? You guys get to make it up. I don't know. And last, what would the indicators, how would they be used? What would you propose that they be used for? Who would use them and to what end? So you've got not very long. Obviously, this could be a year's worth of work or more. But the idea is for you to engage the questions. So let's meet back at 4:25, and then each group will pick somebody to share what was your experience in trying to take these on. Cool? Okay. Well, that's a good point. This is the question of indicators and what do you do with them. I mean, the question is, now you have this data, so what? Now what? So who gets to use it? How is it interpreted? And there's some interpretation discussion here and now. Were you starting, I think, rightly saying it may not be, it's not an indication of maybe what you thought it was going to be an indication of. It's an indicator of something else. But that's the kind of wrangling that happens in the process, right? So we decided on the arts front, on the artist front, to count artist jobs rather than grants or the input part. We were looking at artist jobs from a Bureau of Labor Statistics, expanded measure, and that seemed to work because it didn't implicate any particular source. It was more about the artist rather than the source, and I think what you're describing, we probably would have put under the support domain. It's still an important measure. It's an important measure, but it may not be the measure of what you intended it to be. It's a portion of it. Say that again. We compared it. We did both. So when we had that national indicator, we actually had rankings. I didn't bring these because we don't have enough time, but we had rankings of different metropolitan statistical areas in the states, and you could see that for each of the measures, we had like the top 10, and for each of the measures, there was a different set of top 10. So for example, for artists, it was New York, Los Angeles, Nashville. And Nashville because of the country music scene, right? So it was New York, Los Angeles, Nashville at the time. I think those were the 3 in the top 10. If you were to look at nonprofit arts organizations, it was San Francisco, New York, Minneapolis, because that was the strength. If you were to look at commercial was Los Angeles, New York, I think Nashville again. And then if you looked at festivals and celebrations, it was a whole different slew of cities. So I actually, some people kept saying, well, why don't you develop a composite measure, an index that is one measure that includes many other measures. And at this point in time, I didn't think it was an interesting thing to do or a strategic thing to do because in the States, we're not far enough along as a society to have unpacked that to make good use of it. So people would see that composite indicator and impute into it old ideas about what arts and culture are. They wouldn't know to disaggregate it. And what the point that we were trying to make was that depending on what measure you saw or what measure you were looking at, you would have a different set of places that would show as a strength or weakness. So you could have a city that had a high profile in terms of celebrations and festivals and a low profile in terms of commercial arts establishments. And there were also instances where you had cities that showed up on all of them, and that was telling you something, too. That makes sense? I think that there's an inclination to do that when people feel threatened politically, so they want to be the silver bullet. I advise against it because I don't think, one, it holds up from a research and methodology point of view. I also don't think that it's a good use of money to try to establish causality in contexts where the only way you can really establish causality is when you have very controlled environments, and cities are not very controlled environments. So, I mean, you might be able to do some work that establishes causality, maybe as it relates to arts education, if you have very similar contexts that you're comparing, like in a contained school environment, and even there, you have to accommodate certain kinds of what people say call noise in terms of comparing one thing to another. But I'm not a big fan of that. I mean, at some point, I think what I had on my side was that there were other research methodologists that also shared that point of view. So it kind of tempered the expectation. It wasn't as big an issue when you were actually working with a partner. If you were talking with advocates who were used to pursuing that, you know, you're basically telling them that they need to do something different, and that's change. And so a lot of times there's resistance. That issue of indicator versus measure is always a thorny one because people have different philosophies about what's an indicator and what's a measure. So it sounds like maybe there was some of that there. It's a number. Well, the infant mortality rate is a number, but it's the infant mortality rate that is imbued with a particular meaning that makes it the indicator. So it is that particular meaning that is attached to the measure that turns it from just a metric into something that is telling you more. So and of course there's going to be a discussion about what does it tell you. That's healthy. That's if you arrive at a conclusion fairly easily about what it means, it probably needs to be discussed more. But Boston, the group in Boston, they went on for 2 years about certain measures and what they were actually indicators of. So you guys did fine. Okay, what's another group? We had, just quickly, a quick story about this in Washington, D.C. I pulled together a group to experiment with some of these questions if there was going to be indicators in Washington, D.C. And there, D.C., there's the city itself, which is Washington, and then there is the surrounding area, which is very much integrated with the city, but there it's Maryland and Virginia, so there are two other states. And the D.C. metropolitan area includes the city plus the surrounding suburbs from the two states. So we pulled people together to answer similar questions in the first. This was over three sessions, though, right? This is over three-hour sessions over the course of about 2 months. And the first hang-up was, well, what's D.C.? And, you know, did they want to talk about the city proper, or were they talking about the region? And if they were going to talk about, because we were talking about a scorecard, a cultural vitality scorecard. And if you were going to talk about the region, did you talk about it as a whole thing, or did you separate out the different municipalities within it, and should they compete against each other? And there was no resolution. And the point was to just explore what are the issues when you're going to deal with something like this. But that was the first thing, was geography.
So the point of this, obviously, was not for you to come up with all the answers in any definitive or acceptable way, but it was, if you hadn't thought about some of those questions, to get you to consider the complexity that might be involved, and if you had thought about it, an opportunity for you to share your experience with your colleagues. So I hope it was, I know it was frustrating to do it in a short amount of time, but I hope that it was successful, at least in underscoring or bringing into relief some of the issues that you might deal with as you take this on for the long term. So that was the intention, and I think we're at the end. It's 5:01, so we're 1 minute past drinks time, according to Kim. So thank you for a nice afternoon. And for sharing your ideas and for listening. I enjoyed spending my time with you.